Hey, y'all, welcome back to the Don't Mom Alone podcast. I'm your host, Heather McFadden, and this is the place where I get to walk alongside you and connect you with people and resources so you know that you don't mom alone. And in this episode, I'm welcoming back to the show Dr. Camelia Smith.
So you have to say that it is a biochemistry equation. It is where we live. It's how we get our food. I drive to Mikasena. I don't walk to Miko. And then I drive home from Mikasena and it's 110 degrees and then I lay flat out on my couch. I'm not walking to the market where the temperature's 65 degrees, picking my fresh vegetables, going home, crafting a meal, and then going for a 30-minute walk afterwards. Like, that is not the lifestyle that we all are afforded with. And so it's your genetics, it's how you get your food, it's where you live. And, you know, if you have the luxury of having a personal trainer, a personal chef, and you live in a climate that allows you to be outside 365 days a year and move your body, it's a different story. But genetics matter.
Dr. Smith is the founder and director of Charleston House Gynecology. She's a board certified OBGYN, and she's also a certified menopausal practitioner. She's been on the show twice before, once to talk about perimenopause, another to talk about women's health. And today we are talking about something that's brand new into the news. It's the shift from PCOS to PMOS. And we're talking about why that was an important renaming of a diagnosis so many women have been given, especially in their young 20s, and can be the root cause of some infertility later on. Now, beyond just explaining the science behind this diagnosis, we also get into some of the treatments, and we have a little side conversation on GLP-1s if you've been curious to know more about that from a doctor's perspective. This is a great conversation, lots of practical insight and hope, and a more compassionate approach to women's health. Even some advice if you have daughters and you're looking on how to navigate hormone concerns with them. Let's get right to it. Here we go. Dr. Camelia Smith is back on the show, y'all. Last time you heard from her was September of 2024. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I mean, and I went and listened to a little bit of our conversation, and in it I said that it was my first time to have an episode on women's health. And you were like, I need to know why this is the first time.
Exactly.
And now we're going to keep it going, because how our bodies function impacts the kind of friends we are, the kind of wives we are, and what this show is about, the kind of moms we are. If we're not feeling right, it's no bueno for anybody. So today we're focusing in, though, on a specific diagnosis, and there's big news that came out this week, so we're going to talk about that. But let's start with what this diagnosis was originally called and what it includes. It was called polycystic ovarian syndrome. Is that right? Ovary syndrome or ovarian?
Ovarian.
Okay.
Semantics.
PCOS is what a lot of people say. Tell us about that. Like, what is that?
Well, PCOS, some people call it PCOS, PCOS. What I'll tell you as a clinician and what we know, and then what I think the understanding by the general population and the lay woman has always thought of, polycystic ovarian syndrome has been poorly understood for so long. And it has always been something that's been near and dear to my heart. When I was a fourth year medical student in Charleston, South Carolina, my senior project was on PCOS and just trying to understand the etiology behind it. Because if you can understand the etiology behind something, maybe you can prevent it, right? Like if you're learning something, if you know something's downstream, a diagnosis is something that we've like, oh, that's downstream. The etiology is always what we consider upstream, and upstream is where we can stand to have a huge impact on a woman's life and a journey with a certain disease. But polycystic ovarian syndrome for so long was just really confusing for people. It was like this closed circuit of ovarian dysfunction. And the way I always described it is the ovaries are on an AM radio. And you know how when you're like, when we were growing up, like you're flipping the radio station and it's like, and that's kind of what the ovaries were. They were just this loud static noise that wasn't putting out any beautiful music, so to speak, but nobody really knew where it started. And it was this closed circuit where the ovaries are making these high levels of LH, luteinizing hormone, and making a lot of androgens and just churning out a lot of androgens. And so we knew that to be true, ovarian dysfunction, and that they had this polycystic appearance. Okay. So that's kind of how we got there. This is so long ago.
So and like when you say polycystic appearance, you're looking at an ultrasound and there's just like a bunch of cysts on the ovaries.
We call it the string of pearls, right? And I wouldn't even know that they're cysts, they're follicles, semantics, again, what we consider, you know, a purist that I am as a clinician, but they're follicles and they're not ovulating. And so nobody's able to really produce an follicle every month. And if you can't produce a follicle, then you can't ovulate. You get dominant follicle and then you can't get pregnant. So ovarian dysfunction, lots of cysts on the ovaries.
Okay. You've got a uterus. I'm going real basic. You got a uterus where the baby's growing or which shedding every month. You've got an ovary on each side, hopefully. And these hormones are supposed to communicate to the ovaries, release an egg. And with this syndrome, the hormones are off. Where they're not, they've got all the bumps on them. That's what I'm picturing. I'm just picturing, you said pearls, like all around the ovaries, but nothing's actually happening. So what are women seeing in their, like you said, you're not getting pregnant. So is this, you don't notice it until you're trying to get pregnant? Or would you notice it if you're a teen, a 20-year-old?
So that's a really important segue because it's clinical symptoms that occur that allow women to get a diagnosis. And what happens is, they're anovulatory. So the way I always think about it is if you're standing on your toes, it's really hard to jump, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have this high LH, and LH is what we check, those over-the-counter ovulation kits that we urinate on, those sticks, not the pregnancy ones, but the other ones to see if we're ovulating, we'll say, hey, go get an over-the-counter ovulation prediction kit. Those ovulation prediction kits are looking for that LH hormone in your urine. And so PCOS patients, they'll have positives all over the place because they have this high tonic LH secretion. And really what you want when you think about a menstrual cycle, mid-cycle, is you want a rising FSH, a rising LH, and then you want an LH surge to release a follicle. So you have these really hyperstatic, dysfunctional ovaries, AM radio station, blaring static, high LH, and nobody can rise to the occasion. You're standing on your toes. You can't jump. You can't ovulate. You can't release a follicle. So you don't have cycles.
Oh, no cycles.
So typically you may not have cycles or you may just have very irregular cycles. And that's kind of the hallmark for it. But what I want to say about all of this is it is a clinical diagnosis, meaning we don't need any fancy, you know, diagnostic tools to, and I think that's important about this new nomenclature that we're moving into. You don't have to have any diagnostic criteria outside of clinical things. And so we have all these meeting of the minds to decide what is the true diagnostic criteria for PCOS. So you have two problems going on. One, everybody's focusing on the ovaries. And number two, no one can agree on how to diagnose it or what gets a woman a diagnosis. And the Rotterdam criteria is the oldest criteria ever used. And what's what I wrote my paper on a bajillion years ago when I was in medical residency. And the Rotterdam criteria requires you to have this string of pearls appearance on an ultrasound. So what you see is this beautiful ovary, and then you see this like these pearls around the outside of it. Well, you can have that and it doesn't necessarily get you the diagnosis. And so where we went wrong with women is we would see that on a sono. And maybe she's just anovulatory for one cycle and she would get the diagnosis for PCOS. And I can't tell you how many sonographers I've had work for me over the years. Well, they'll do a sono report and they'll write on it possible PCOS because they see a string of pearls. And I'm like, no. That is not how we make the diagnosis. It is a clinical diagnosis. It is the woman's inability to lose weight. She has clinical evidence of hyperandrogenism. And that means these dark terminal hairs on her chin, midline hair distribution, like you shouldn't have dark hair. As a woman, we should never have dark hairs down the middle of our chest, all the way down our belly button, all the way down. So abnormal hair distribution, it's a terminal dark hair.
What is terminal dark
terminals, hair? Terminal is a word we use, meaning those dark, really coarse ones. Not that little like peach fuzz we have to like tinkle off our faces, you know, that we
get older. So it sounds like androgen is like a testosterone precursor?
Yes. Okay. So hyperandrogenism is what we say in the medical field as the clinical criteria for it. You do not need to check labs. You don't even need to do a sono. But we were basing it on so many of these other things. And why that has been sort of a disservice to people is because those of us that take care of women across the span of their lifetime know that there's bigger fish to fry here. These women are set up for diabetes, cardiovascular disease, metabolic syndrome. And metabolic syndrome means a lot of things. It means you are, it's a term that was given to a host of factors that don't quite get you a diagnosis. So true metabolic syndrome means your blood pressure is in a pre-hypertensive range. Your blood sugar, your fasting blood glucose shows glucose intolerance. It's a borderline or elevated fasting blood glucose. You have an increased abdominal waist circumference ratio. You have all these other things, and that's considered metabolic syndrome. And I remember the first time I saw metabolic syndrome was on a shelf exam when I was a fourth year resident in 2007. And somebody was like, oh, let's throw metabolic syndrome on a test and see if these kids can even figure out what that is. But metabolic syndrome, I would not get caught up on what that means. That's what you would think it means. It's somebody who's probably gaining visceral fat, slowly developing insulin resistance. They just haven't met a diagnosis for anything, but all these comorbidities and all these medical problems are starting to set up that you know that eventually they're going to result in something. So the fact that PCOS was never all about the ovaries is why the name was such a misnomer. And also, I think it reduces the state to thinking it's just a reproductive issue. Mm-hmm. And it's not a reproductive issue. But that's that downstream problem. I don't want to wait till a woman can't have babies to be concerned about her PCOS. I want to understand all the things that are setting up prior to that so that we can intervene and have an impact in her life. And so that's why PMOS, the polymetabolic or polyendocrine metabolic syndrome, ovarian syndrome, is much more important. Now, listen, it's going to take forever to get the name formally changed. We're just changing some of the nomenclature around it. I don't think it's going to change how I practice, how I've always practiced. But what I do think it lends to is these young girls in the pediatrician's office all the way to the OB-GYN's office, they need to be looked at as a holistic picture of, hey, if they are at increased risk for PMOS, maybe we do need to intervene earlier. Maybe we do need to be looking at weight distribution. Maybe we do need to be looking at what these elevated testosterone levels really mean. Also, something I think you should understand is too many women were given the wrong diagnosis. And if you get on TikTok, Heather, just spend 5 minutes on TikTok and put in PCOS, you might as well just go like fall off a cliff because you're getting nowhere anytime soon.
Is it just like, are they even doctors? Are they people that think they have it?
No, I mean, like when you're 13, when you start your period for the first time, you have a big grace period. You have a huge grace period to have irregular cycles. You don't have to really, that pituitary, so there's the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland, and we call it the GnRH axis. And that's the talk between the brain and the ovaries. You get a long time for that to mature. Your axis has to mature for a really long time. And when I see young girls in the office, I'll say, hey, you're mature, but your axis is not mature yet. And so it gets a long time to get to develop. So women who are having these irregular cycles at a young age, I see people stamp PCOS on them. And I'm like, well, you get a long time to be, your axis gets a long time to be immature. So we were over-diagnosing people with it, which I don't think is really the right thing to do. When you tell a young woman something, it sticks with her for the rest of her life. And when she hears it from somebody who's in a place of authority, a scary person in a white coat that their mom drug them into the office, you have to be very careful with your words because they can have a lasting impact on a woman and she will define herself by that. And so I've seen women in the office that are like, well, I have PCOS. I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Why and how do we know that you do? And well, because somebody told me when I was 13. I'm like, well, I don't really know that you can say that when you're 13. And so one, we've been reducing it just to do an ovarian dysfunction problem and not trying to think about all the other ways we can be intervening in a woman's life from a metabolic standpoint. But also, we have to be careful giving somebody a diagnosis because, again, you get on TikTok and they're going to tell you that you're never going to have a normal life and you're never going to have a baby. And that is not true. Mm-hmm. That is not true. So women can go too many years with the wrong diagnosis, too many years without the right diagnosis. You know, that's kind of the thing.
Okay, so I'm going to say back what I think you've said and you correct me. So what I'm hearing is, with PCOS, one, it's been overdiagnosed because of just it takes a young girl a long time to get a steady period because her body's still maturing in that communication path. Two, it's diagnosed solely based on an ultrasound, which is not a full look at like those androgen cues of hot, like the hair growth and the weight distribution. And three, the name itself was not a full enough view of what's actually going on so that you can be upstream and treat it better, like more holistically. Correct. So the new term, if y'all didn't catch it, is polyendocrine. Endocrine, I think of an endocrinologist. I think of my thyroid stuff. You were talking about pituitary, all these places where hormones are produced, right? Your endocrine system is your hormone system?
Yes.
Okay. So polyendocrine metabolic, which when I hear metabolic, I think of, well, one, I think of digestion, but that probably is wrong. I think of how cells are processing things and like metabolizing, which may be wrong. And then ovarian is still in there. So polyendocrine metabolic ovarian syndrome is the new name. PMOS.
Yes.
PMOS. But in that P, cystic was replaced with endocrine. So, okay. P-E-M-O is what I would call it.
PMOS. It's going to sound like PMS. It's going to sound like PMS, but
it's going to sound like PMS. Okay. PMOS is the new one. My question is, how was it treated in the former? Like if you were given a diagnosis as a kid and maybe told you'll never have children or whatever, and how does the new diagnosis change what the treatment would be?
Well, I think that what it does is it lends to the fact that there's other things going on and that the ovary is a messenger, not the root cause. The ovary is another messenger that there is something else at play, right? And so instead of deciding that it was all about the ovary before and that everything else was a result of that, our treatment was always, let's suppress the ovaries. Let's take that AM radio and dial it way down so we don't have to listen to the dysfunction, and let's make it make sense. And so we do that by birth control pills with ovulation suppression with a combined oral contraceptive pill. And the COC combined is important because you need the estradiol portion of it. A combined pill is estrogen plus progesterone. A progesterone-only pill will not have the same impact. And the reason we did that was twofold. Number one was to quiet down the ovaries and hope that some of these, you know, closed circuit pathways of insulin, high circulating levels of insulin and developing insulin resistance would be an outcome of shutting off the ovaries. But also we did that because when these women have unopposed and ovulatory cycles, they're not ovulating every month, they're making a lot of estrogen, and that can stimulate the lining of the uterus. And over time, that can thicken the lining. And when you have a thick lining in the uterus, we always think about it this way. When you go to a concert and there's a lot of people and it gets crowded, you get a lot of crowding of the glands in the uterus. And when people get really crowded, they start to act atypical. Like I took my daughter to ACL and I saw some real atypical behavior as everybody was crowded. That is, so you can get glandular crowding with atypia. And atypia means, oh, I might want to get cancer. And so we were doing things for a lot of reasons. Like we were treating. So that is not going to change. We still have to protect a woman's uterine lining. We still need to look at the long-term ramifications of her not ovulating consistently every month, even outside of her fertility desires. But the real thing that we have to understand is that the ovaries are a messenger in this. They're not the root cause in this. And that is where we have to treat things differently. And we've known that lifestyle modifications can have an impact on this disease. We've known it for a really long time. But now we know even more so that if we treat things like inflammation, insulin resistance, those types of things, the ovaries will get better. And it's not, the ovaries are not the root cause. They're just over here screaming, hey, things ain't right in my neck of the woods, but I didn't cause it necessarily. And so the way I want you to think about it and the way we used to think about it is so much focus on the ovaries and so many reproductive ramifications to that, and not really have an impact on somebody's long-term comorbidities, her long-term ability to have a healthy life. And if we look at it differently and we look at it from a metabolic standpoint, we stand to have a lot more impact on how a woman will live longer and live healthier. And that is why this is really important and exciting. It doesn't change my practice though. I have been practicing this way. I mean, GLPs are the way.
That's what I was literally going to ask you.
And we were putting all these patients on metformin. And metformin,
I've never heard of metformin.
Metformin is a diabetic drug. And I see patients come in all the time with PCOS on metformin. And I'm going to say something that you might cut out on this podcast. It's like fart. It's like farting in the wind. Don't come in here on metformin. It's not going to do anything for you. And it's certainly not going to help you lose weight.
So it's like a drug. Like if you're diagnosed with diabetes, they would give you that. Yes. And it would work if you had diabetes?
We were hoping that it would drive down some of the insulin resistance that's occurring and maybe wake up the ovaries.
But I'm saying like for someone who is diagnosed with diabetes, metformin is a working drug, but they were applying it to this other situation, hoping that it would help, and it wasn't helping.
Yes.
So it's not like metformin, it doesn't work across the board. You're just saying for this situation,
correct,
it doesn't work. Okay, I really do want to talk about GLP-1s because if you're willing – because I do think
love it.
This stage, I have a lot of friends in the mid, late 40s who are so sick of how their bodies are, how they're doing all the right things, eating all the protein, drinking all the water, and they feel depressed. It's like so bad. I haven't told my audience, but I went on a GLP-1 at the end of August and have been doing it very low dose, and I have never felt more amazing in all of my life.
Yeah, you want to know what? I've been on a GLP since 2020.
Okay.
2020.
Okay. So what I need to know, what are the negatives?
Well, I mean, if they get in the wrong hands.
Okay.
I will just tell you that, you know, I come from a family of obesity. My mom had a four-vessel cabbage. She had gastric bypass surgery. She had diabetes. She had hypertension. And she was on every diet under the sun. I watched her try everything growing up. We never had sweets in our house. We never had anything in our house because we were always trying to avoid everything, you know, and she had early onset dementia, probably because of her comorbidities. And so we could do a whole talk on dementia prevention on what the data is showing, which ones are showing promise, what can we extrapolate from that, but not for today. But, you know, I did, so during COVID, I would sit at my dining room table and do virtuals all day long. It was the only way I could reach women. And if women ever needed to be reached, it was during COVID because the fear, the angst, also having to be around your children, your spouse all day long that you're not used to, that's a lot. And it was a lot. And I would sit at my dining room table doing all these virtuals and I would look out and see all my neighbors in the street with social distancing, but like drinking and eating. And I was like, and it was getting earlier and earlier in the day. And I was like, oh man, people are going to come in when the world reopens, the weight gain is going to be off the hook. Yeah. And in fact, on average, the average weight gain during COVID was 18 pounds per individual. Okay. So 18, doesn't matter who you are.
All that bread we baked.
I mean, all the sourdough. Yeah. So, I mean, I love food. Yeah. So I started doing my obesity medicine certification during COVID because I was online and I knew it was a good time. And I knew these drugs were really smart. So there are a lot of us that have known about these drugs for a really long time and have been prescribing them quite safely. And my fridge was full of Ozempic. I had pins. I was throwing them out, which shame on me now. I'm like, I did not realize how impactful they were, but I had all these samples. And so my internist was like, hey, you've gained 30 pounds, your blood pressure's creeping up, you have a family history of obesity, you have a family history of dementia, you're going on a small dose. So she was the one that said—
So you have a doctor.
Yeah, I have a doctor. And she was like, hey, I know you've got a fridge over there, what's holding you up? And so I went on it. But what I will tell you is I use it in a way so that my patients don't walk in and think, God, what's going on with my doctor? Why does she look, you know, emaciated? I try to be a very good steward of the medication and I use it to, and we do a lot of body composition analysis and I am fighting tooth and nail because I'm 51 and I went through menopause to hold on to my muscle mass and my bone mass. So I am a very good steward of the drug and I am doing it to keep my lipids in check, to keep my blood pressure in check, and also to keep my dementia risk in check. So it depends on why and how you use these drugs, but they are wonderful. And also just this week, and I'm happy to come back and talk more about this. We won't be able to get to it today. There was an exciting, exciting study released. They were in my office this week, the reps from the company. They looked at women who were on these GLP drugs in menopause and perimenopause. And when used with hormone therapy, you saw almost a 40% reduction in migraines and depression. So we're treating the whole woman with one medication, and they're super smart drugs. It's just when you're getting them at your gym and you're getting them at your dentist and you're getting them at your chiropractor, it's confusing to the consumer. I'm not saying that there isn't, you know, maybe good medicine being practiced outside of that, but like when you get a drug from somebody and they can't manage the side effect of it, like if my patient, heaven forget, gets gastroparesis or pancreatitis, I need to be able to admit her to, I need to be able to draw blood work in my office. I need to be able to triage her over the phone. I need to be able to lay eyes on her, do a medical assessment, and get her into the ER. Gastroparesis. It's where your stomach stops working.
Oh, that seems like a problem.
Yeah, that's terrible.
And
that's
you said pancreatitis. Is that an infection of your pancreas?
No, that's an inflammation of your pancreas and where it shuts down. And it's a very, very, very scary situation should it occur.
So those could be side effects. This is why we're giving
I've never seen it,
but this is why you say if you're choosing GLP-1s, do it in conjunction with a doctor's guidance who's like keeping up with symptoms that could happen in your body. I talk to friends because they'll know that I'm on it and they'll be like, okay, how do you deal with this? I'm like, I'm not your doctor, first of all, but I will tell you, you need to drink a lot of water. Please drink a lot of water and make sure when you do eat, you prioritize good choices. Like that's helped me. I haven't had like the nausea or the any other gastro issues, but I'm like, this is why you need a doctor. You need to talk to a doctor because your body's going to respond in a unique way. Now, to put us back on track with PMOS, are you saying that the GLP-1s are being now used to treat PMOS now that, I mean, I know the new label is of this week, but like, have you used it and seen success?
Okay. So we have to be careful with saying things like, can we use GLPs to treat this diagnosis? Here's what we do. We use GLPs to minimize a woman's risk of certain disease processes. And again, I always say, like, I don't want you to be hypertensive, dyslipidemia, and diabetic before I give you a GLP. I want to treat upstream to prevent the things that are downstream. And so when we think about PMOS, we're thinking about insulin resistance, increased visceral fat. We're thinking about all the things that are setting up in a woman's body. So do I use these drugs for that? Yes.
Okay.
To be used to treat a disease, it's going to have to be studied and it's going to have to get an FDA approval. And listen, we ain't going to be alive long enough to get a FDA approval for all the things we need to be using drugs for. So we'd use things off label. That is not bad practice. Using things off label sometimes means that the FDA has not approved it for this indication. But when we have an elevated BMI and a high visceral fat in a woman.
What's high visceral fat? Like what's a number?
It depends. Like we look at the surface area of the visceral fat. It depends on the units that you're looking at, the scale that you're using. It depends. Because we're looking at, ours is surface area, and you know you have to measure surface area, and surface area differs from woman to woman. But that visceral fat is the stuff.
It means fat on your organs, right?
Yeah, it's stuff you can't see. But when I go in and operate on a woman, I can see that. And I can see it on really skinny women. And I'm like, well, this is where they hold it. And that has the highest link to cardiovascular disease than anything. But I think, you know, one last thing I'd want to say about the GLPs, and then we can come back and do like a more thoughtful conversation about it is not about trying harder, being better, and doing gooder. Trying harder, being better, and doing gooder. Because Heather, if it was, Heather McFadden would have already done that. And she probably already did. Mm-hmm. And so you have to say that it is a biochemistry equation. It is where we live. It's how we get our food. I drive to Mikasina. I don't walk to Miko. And then I drive home from Mikasina and it's 110 degrees. And then I lay flat out on my couch. I'm not walking to the market where the temperature's 65 degrees, picking my fresh vegetables, going home, crafting a meal, and then going for a 30-minute walk afterwards. Like that is not the lifestyle that we all are afforded with. And so it's your genetics. It's how you get your food. It's where you live. And, you know, if you have the luxury of having a personal trainer, a personal chef, and you live in a climate that allows you to be outside 365 days a year and move your body, it's a different story. But genetics matter. Genetics do matter. Yeah. And also, if you've had a lifetime of restriction or a major stressor in your life. I've seen this in women who've had a really big stressor in their life, like they've lost a child or a spouse that's had cancer and or a divorce, and they drop 30 pounds, right? Not because they're trying, they drop 30 pounds. Their body is very resistant to these drugs at first because their body's like, hey, I don't trust you because you didn't feed me. Is this another stress response? The body has a reset point and it's going to pull you back to it. It's what we would call our happy weight. The body tries to pull you back to a happy weight and it does it in a really mean way. Your body will always outsmart you. It's really cruel. It says, hey, I'm going to drive up your hunger signals and I'm going to burn less at rest. So it means the skinnier you get, I'm going to make you hungrier and I'm going to make sure you don't burn as much calories when you're just sitting still recording.
It's trying to protect itself. Yeah.
Yeah. So these drugs are smarter than that. They're smarter than the reset point. And that is why they matter. And then, you know, I always say, don't break up with them completely. Stay on a very, very tiny dose, a whiff, to keep those receptors open. Because if you stop the drug completely and then come back later, because your body hit that reset point and say, hey, I want to get back on that, it takes a minute for those receptors to even recognize the drug. So even if you use like the tiniest dose once a month, that's real off label. Don't quote me on that. If all of the world is going to hear that I just said that, like it's, you just don't want to completely stop it because the receptors have to stay open to the medication. And then you just have to say, I have to decide, do I want to take blood pressure medication later in life or do I want to treat something upstream? And not to say that you're going to be on blood pressure medication, but when you walk in the office and you're pre-hypertensive or hypertensive and your cholesterol is starting to move up, then it's like, hey, age and genetics are the things that we're always trying to outpace. Yeah. So I want to be able to drive up the good stuff and drive down the bad stuff. My genetics and my age are the things that I need to drive down, and I can overcome that with smart tools like these GLPs. And PMOS is another way that we're going to see complete use of these medications to drive down some of the things that go along with PMOS, which is inflammation, insulin resistance, increased visceral fat, and the setup for cardiometabolic disease. And so I think it's a good thing that we have tools, and it's a good thing that we can give women hope. And I would, if I was a betting woman, we're going to see that fertility will increase for these patients that have always been tagged as PCOS. Now they're going to be PMOS and they're going to have hope because people are thinking of them through a different lens.
I love that. I'm going to read to you what this friend, she reposted a doctor who had talked about the renaming. And my friend wrote, this is a huge breakthrough. I was diagnosed with PCOS at 21 and told I'd be on birth control pills the rest of my life and need fertility treatments to conceive. I bucked the system, studied nutrition, cleaned up my diet and lifestyle, got more active, and ultimately had 6 healthy pregnancies. At 45, I currently have the most regular cycles I've had my entire life, which has come through additional nervous system regulation, better sleep, improved lymphatic flow, and more consistent strength building. Addressing metabolic issues is an absolute key. That comes from the mouth of a person. Because I told you, I'm like, I don't have experience with this personally in that way, but I just saw this friend and I was like, bless her heart. Like she basically figured it out on her own.
Yeah. I think the fatigue, the brain fog, all of it. I mean, it's the mood changes. And you know, something I want to talk about too, we talked a lot about high testosterone levels. And if we didn't, I was remiss not to say that.
But these you did. You the androgen signs.
Yeah. These women have really high testosterone levels. And you know, I do a lot of work in the sexual function space. And I was speaking at a conference on sexual function and how weight impacts, obesity impacts a woman's relationship with herself and obviously sexual function. And within that, I wanted to touch on PCOS patients. And I think this is really interesting because a lot of you women out there think that if I have low sex drive, that it's got to be my hormones. And let me just say, there's a lot of reasons why women don't want to have sex. And hormones is just one of them. Unfortunately, we're very complicated. But if you subscribe to the fact that testosterone is the reason that you need additional testosterone to want to have sex. If you look at PCOS patients, and there's a ton of data on this, they have very low sex drive. And guess what they have? Very high testosterone levels. So again, there's more going on here than just ovarian dysfunction, high androgen levels. And that is what we were reducing it to when we were calling it PCOS, PCOS, however you refer to it.
I'm looking at all our questions. I feel like in one way or another, you've answered them well. Is there one that you feel like I have not asked?
I think that if you want to be fully evaluated, regardless if you think you have PCOS or PMS or what you do, and this is what we do at our practice, our patients get a fasting insulin, they get a body comp scan, we do full lipids, we do lipoprotein B, we do a LPA, we do homocysteine levels, we look at all the cardiometabolic factors, and we, you know, a lot of women want to know what their AMH is. We dive into those hormones, total testosterone, free testosterone, and then you have to look at it in the whole picture and say, well, is this what I have? But what I would really recommend women do is not go looking for a diagnosis, go looking for a clinician that understands maybe what the root cause of all their symptoms are, and then let's treat those symptoms, regardless of what diagnosis you feel like. Don't identify yourself by a name. Identify yourself as somebody who is looking to optimize their health and looking for answers for some of the symptoms that they have, because I think we can get really tripped up on a name. And just like that young girl that's in a doctor's office when she's 14, and if somebody looks at her and says, oh, you have PCOS, that may not be the case for her. Mm-hmm. That may not be the case.
Mm-hmm. What's a small lifestyle shift that you think can make a meaningful difference for those with PMOS?
Move your body. Moving your body is insulin resistance. And so a HIIT workout is great, but that's not moving your body. Like, I used to do Orange Theory and then I was like laid out for the rest of the day. Like, don't make me move. Well, that wasn't necessarily good for my body. So between patients, or if I have to call a patient, I put these on, I go downstairs and I start walking between patients. Moving your body throughout the day, finding ways to move your body drives down insulin resistance. I know that sounds so small and so simple, but it's not easy. Simple things are not always easy. Move your body. Move your body for 20 minutes after a meal. Drag your husband out of the house and say, we're just going to walk for 20 minutes. And even if it's just 10, if I'm at home and I have to take a call, my kids know she's going to be out walking the streets. So if you see me walking the streets looking like a crazy woman talking to myself, I'm trying to move my body. That is much more important than getting to the gym and killing yourself for an hour and then sit and squat, then sit and flat on your high knee for the rest of the day. So movement really does matter. And that lateral eye movement helps with brain cognition. It helps with mental health. And so moving your body outside is very, 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 very important. It's probably one of the most beneficial things you can do. And I know it's simple, but not easy to do. But in fact, it kind of is. You just have to make it become a habit. So when we get off this call, Heather, you need to go walk around for 10 minutes. Okay.
Okay. I'm going to go do that. What do you wish moms knew when they were supporting their daughters with hormone related symptoms? Cause you have a daughter.
I have two.
You have two daughters.
And I think this might make me a little teary, but you know, you just, as a mom, you worry so much about your kids. And I grew up in a house where I watched the women in my life really battle their weight. And so, you know, I know genetics can be there, but I also am from the Middle East. And so we make a lot of dark hair. We're very hairy people, but we're not PCOS. But I worried about my children when they were younger, just that maybe having some of that obesity genetic imprint already there. That was a fear that I had. And then finding dark hairs on them when they were really young, I was like, oh my God, they've got precocious puberty. So I just worried about all the things. And what I would say is let your kids be kids. Teach them how to eat well-balanced things. Let them have dessert when it's time to have dessert. Don't restrict them. Don't hover over them when it comes to food and relationship with self, because the world is going to do enough damage to them on its own. And so let them be what the beautiful little individuals that God designed them to be at a very young age. Don't drag them into offices trying to get diagnosis because you're trying to treat your own fears. Just don't do it. And I, you know, personally, I say, you know, you hand them over to the Lord and hopefully God knows. But I worried about a lot of different things because I knew too much. I knew too much about PCOS. I knew too much about my genetics. And I just worried about the stupidest things when they were little. Yeah. And you have to just let them. And so some people are probably like, I can't, my husband's a physician. Like, I can't believe those doctors let their kids eat that stuff. Like, that's terrible. But we were letting them try to self-regulate it at an early age instead of completely restricting it. Like I was restricted as a young girl because it wasn't allowed in my house because my mom was battling her weight. And so I also think that you want to set a good example for your kids. So, you know, if I am with a girlfriend and she starts talking about how much weight she's lost or what GLP she's on, I'm like, hey, can we talk about this later? Can we, like, you know, I just like say, hey, let's, you know, I kind of move the conversation over. Just not having those types of conversations with your girls when they're young, because they may love their body regardless of what it looks like. And that is what you want them to do. You want them to love their body early on. And so I think not putting our fears onto them is really important. And when I see women in the office who probably have the most to unpack, it's because they thought that their mom never really approved of their body and who they were and drug them around to a lot of doctor's offices when they were younger. And nutritionists when they were little and things like that. And I can tell you that backfires. It has the opposite effect of what you want it to have on your child. And so that might be a real heavy, hard thing to hear, but I do think I get to see women 20, 30 years after the thing that the events already happened. And that's what women will share with me. And so I think, you know, not forcing a diagnosis onto our child at a really young age. It's far too soon to decide that they have something like PCOS or PMOS and let their pediatrician really navigate that and be that cruise ship director for that sort of process. And, you know, I just had to kind of just quiet down all the things that were rolling through my head that we moms do it. Right. And then you give us some medical knowledge and we're just like
I was that way with speech pathology things. Don't you?
Yes. Mind? Right. Like, yes.
You know, too much. But my question for you, and this is, so you said you want to get upstream, but then we don't want to diagnose too early. So if there's a mom and she doesn't want to be overly concerned, but like, what if her daughter has started ovulating and what like things should be red flags that it's like, okay, it's not necessarily the weight thing. It's like, when do they get concerned and at what point so that they can stay upstream for PMOS? If we're changing the name and we're not just sticking to the ovaries, like it feels tricky, like a little tricky, like don't worry about it, but then worry about it.
It is. Well, yeah. I think number one is if you are noticing that a young woman is withdrawing and having issues with body image because she is overweight, then that is a different scenario. Then I think you have to start slowly but surely working through that with a multidisciplinary approach. And that means getting some other smart people at the table. And maybe that includes some cognitive behavioral therapy around body image and her relationship with herself. And that can start at a really young age. I think that's one thing that you can do. If the weight is impacting her relationship with herself because she doesn't look like her peers, then that is a really sweet time to be able to intervene. But that is, again, that doesn't come just from a doctor saying, oh, you have this diagnosis. I think the other thing is you have to be honest and say, are we moving our bodies? What are we doing to be healthy, right? Like, and I don't know, I don't ever use the word healthy in our house. But my kids know if they fuel well, they feel well. And so if you fuel poorly, you probably feel poorly. And so we talk a lot about how you fuel yourself is how you will feel about yourself. And so fueling, what are you fueling your body with, right? But they do need calories when they're growing. They do need carbohydrates for their brain. You can't just take those things away from them. And you have to give their body time. That axis has to mature.
Like how long does that take when you say?
Oh, it takes years. It takes years.
So like maybe 18, 19, if they're still having, the cycles aren't happening.
Correct. You cannot diagnose PCOS within the first 6 years of starting your period, hands down.
Okay. So wait, they would not get a PMOS until like 21. No. Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's what I was wondering. I'm like, how, like if we want to stay ahead of it, but we don't, if they haven't had a cycle that's consistent,
And they're not going to be consistent. They're not going to be consistent. Yeah. And the young women that we were previously using the diagnosis for PCOS for, well, one of the hallmarks of PCOS is anovulatory cycle. So these girls might start their periods early, but then they'll go into a scenario where they don't have periods anymore and they stop cycling. And maybe they have a period once or twice a year. So it looks very different, but really that axis has to mature in their brain, that conversation between the brain and the ovaries. It's a pulsatile, like when your heart beats, it's a pulsatile. Well, that pulsatile is like beat, beat, long pause, beat, beat. That doesn't become really truly pulsatile for a really long time. So irregular cycles are not abnormal. They're
this
very
is good
common.
Information too. Not that I'm like looking around if there's a child present, but like I have been hearing where there are apps where girls can track their periods and their boyfriends will also have the same app and the boyfriends will know their cycles.
I mean.
Yeah. And so what you're telling me in a conversation we need to have with our girls, I don't have girls, but with our children, teens, is if you are active sexually with your boyfriend, girlfriend, and you're tracking, thinking you're being so smart, that system is not a regular system yet.
It's not
so
ready.
Those apps are made for a fully.
Yeah. It's not, that is not locked and loaded and ready. Yeah. It's not locked and loaded and ready.
Anyway,
to go.
I'm just saying if you're thinking we're not using any other protection, we're just going to use this app. I'm just telling you, moms, you got to have these conversations. These are good. I think also what you said about the TikTok, we got to have these conversations because the information they're getting from TikTok that they're not telling us. They think they're so smart.
Oh, I mean, TikTok is a whole thing. I just hired a really young, beautiful whippersnapper to do some TikTok for Charleston House. And she was like, that's where we all go to find our doctors. We go to TikTok. We're not on Instagram. We're not on Facebook. And she's like, I put something up there about Charleston House and we got 9,000 views. I'm like, what? Yeah. And so TikTok is where it is. And there's a lot of good
information. Unfortunately for you, yeah.
No, and I think there's some good information out there. I think there probably is, but there's plenty of not good information. But what I love about this generation is they're wanting to learn about their health. And we did not do that when we were growing up. So I applaud them for that. I applaud them for the fact that they are trying to get more information about their health. I love that. Yeah. I think it's amazing.
Okay. I know we could talk for 3 hours about this, but our time is up. Is there any last thing that you had written notes about and you wanted to make sure people heard with this transition? I feel like you've done a really good job of explaining it, explaining what we need to do, the impact, how they can advocate for themselves. I feel like you've done a great job. Anything else you'd like to say?
I think that once again, the conversation is just moving at a rapid pace. And man, aren't we lucky to have a time like this? I mean, three things this week, the PCOS nomenclature being transitioned into PMOS, findings that these weight loss medications, when combined use with menopausal hormone therapy, show a reduction in migraines and depression. So relationship with self improves across the board. That was huge. And then there was one other thing, and actually it happened last week, and that was how we evaluate women who have abnormal bleeding on hormones. Like the conversation is just moving. And so good for you, job security for you. Your podcast is going to be chock full of people looking to talk about their health because things are just moving at such a quick pace. And I think it's incredible. And I haven't even had time after seeing patients all week to even dig in really into some of this, the minutiae of some of this, and how it's going to trickle down to the bedside and how I'm going to use it best practice and integrate it into my practice with women. So more to come on that.
But still developing.
The conversation is moving.
It's moving. I'm very encouraged at all that, like last time you were on 2 years ago, we were like, now people are talking about perimenopause. Think of how much has happened in the last 2 years regarding treatment and help and support and products.
And guess what? These symptoms of PMOS sound just like the symptoms of perimenopause. And I see women coming in at like 39 who think they're in perimenopause and they're not quite there yet. And it's probably something like this. So we have so much to learn, But again, doesn't matter what the diagnosis is. If I have tools and I know how to treat them and improve their quality of life, we're going to use those before we try to hang our hat on a diagnosis.
So good. Thank you for joining me, Camellia. I love any time with you.
Love seeing you.
And I'll see you soon, I'm sure, somewhere.
Okay, friend. Take care.
Now, I was a pre-med biology major in college, but I wouldn't say that I fully understand everything related to this topic. But I was super curious when Dr. Smith reached out about this change in diagnosis. And I did see, like I mentioned in the show, a friend who shared about how it impacted her life. And so if you're someone who has also experienced this diagnosis, I hope that this conversation was helpful. If you have daughters, I hope it was really helpful to help guide them. Definitely check the show notes for Dr. Smith's contact info. If you're local to Dallas, she does have a great office specializing in women's health. So I'm going to pray for us. Lord, you have made us. You've created women to bring life into the world, and yet so much is going on in our bodies from the impact of the world and from genetics and from all the things, and we want to function our best, and we want to be wholly, wholly available to what you have for us to do, the good things that you've planned for us to do. I know there are such great doctors who are doing amazing research and trying to figure out how to better care for women in this area. And I pray over the heartache and the hurt and the pain of those who've experienced some of these diagnoses for years, decades. And I pray over I just know that it can be discouraging. I pray for hope. I pray for breakthrough. I pray for the right care, which can often be so hard to find. And I just thank you, God, that we know you are in all things. And we thank you for doctors like Dr. Smith who are doing this work and caring about women. And Jesus' name, amen. Okay, I'll meet you back here next week. We have our Inner Healing Prayer, Freedom Prayer series. We're going to do a two-part series with my friend Jennifer Barnett. The first one is just an overall talking again about prayer and why people come to be prayed for and what is it involved. And the second one is for our kids. How do we raise up the next generation to be those who go to God in prayer with our heartaches and our challenges and with the goal of being as connected to God as we can be. So join me for those next 2 weeks. Don't miss it. If you aren't subscribed to the show, go ahead and do that so you don't miss an episode. Easy to do in whatever podcast player you use. All right, see you back here next week. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Don't Mom Alone podcast. If you're wanting to connect with more people and more resources to help remind you that you're not alone, head over to don'tmomalone.com. That's where you'll also find show notes with any links mentioned by our guests. Most importantly, I want you to know the good news, the great news that you're not alone because God has promised to always be with you. With faith in Jesus Christ, the one who died for you and rose again, Jesus said when he left, he was going to leave a helper, a comforter, to be with us. God in us. Moms, that's superpower. So while you're washing dishes at your kitchen sink, while you're driving to and from work, while you're feeding that baby late into the night, while you're cleaning sticky floors, God promises to be just as present with you as when you're worshiping in a church pew. As it says in Zephaniah 3:17, the Lord your God is with you. He is mighty to save. He takes great delight in you. He will quiet you with his love, and he will rejoice over you with singing. Now that's good news. Have a great day.